Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I am David Monda, and I am the host for this channel. This is a podcast for the Gotham Center at the Graduate Center CUNY. And today we'll be talking to our guest, Rose Manzio. And she'll be telling us about her new book, Radical Imagination, Radical Humanity, Puerto Rican Political Activism in New York. And I'm very excited about this book. And thank you very much, Rose Manzio, for being on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I am an associate professor at the State University of New York, Old Westbury, and currently the chair of the Politics, Economics, and Law Department there. Raised in New York. Oddly enough, I was born in Alabama, because my father was in the service there. So came to New York when I was 3 months old and grew up in a, you know, Italian-American and Puerto Rican community in Brooklyn. And then also spent some years on Long Island. So I kind of lived in both places on and off. And I've been a political activist for many years, went to graduate school at the Graduate Center. So I have my PhD from CUNY grad, and I believe that's where you now study, if I'm not mistaken, or teach.
Correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. This is very nice. Thank you so much for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. And how does your background fit into your inspiration to write the book? I know you mentioned, you know, Alabama and you know, and you're living in the city. How did that shape sort of your understanding or your thinking in, before you even came to writing the book?
Well, as I said, and I do mention in the book, I was a political activist. You know, growing up in a working class community, I was impacted by all of the conditions that, you know, people experience, struggles with, you know, job security and, you know, quality education, access to quality health care. And I was a member, actually, of this organization that I write about. The organization was founded some years before I became a member, but I understood the organization existed for 10 years in the 1970s, and it was predominantly Puerto Rican. It formed in the Upper West Side in the context of a community housing struggle, a tenant struggle. And, you know, I knew that this was an untold story. that the activism of people of color, of Puerto Ricans in particular, had not been adequately studied or represented in either popular or scholarly literature. And, you know, as a teacher, I mean, I started teaching in 1992. I realized that, you know, many students come to us from high school knowing something about the civil rights movement, but it's a very partial understanding. You know, they think of the civil rights movement as basically centered in the South and centered around, you know, individual heroes, basically for voting rights or to end segregation. But as I say, this is a partial understanding because we had so many civil rights struggles right here in New York. And when I say civil rights struggles, I mean not only struggles against police brutality, struggles for housing rights, for quality education, but for economic rights as well, for jobs, against racist exclusion from, you know, various jobs, exclusion from unions. So, you know, this is a gap that I wanted to fill. In addition, I'll just say one other thing about motivations. The scholarly literature, the stories told about Puerto Rican activism that I read, you know, this is now in the 1990s, misrepresented the scope, the breadth of Puerto Rican activism in New York by claiming that the Puerto Rican left or Puerto Rican activists were primarily concerned with independence for Puerto Rico and ignored the needs and the interests of the Puerto Rican diaspora. And that was a misconception. There's no doubt that many activists on the left were and continue to be concerned with the colonial situation in Puerto Rico, but the activism that I write about for democratic rights, for jobs, for better education and healthcare was very much centered on the needs of, you know, Puerto Ricans in New York.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a good point. Where do you think that disconnect comes from? Is it just time? Is it just not in terms of attention to detail? Where does that gap come from in terms of that misperception?
Well, I think, you know, many of the gaps have been filled in the recent 10, maybe even 20 years. But in the 1980s and 1990s, many of the stories of the left were written by white scholars. And I think there was just a broad, brush that generalized about Puerto Rican activism in particular, you know, that made these assumptions. I do think it's just, an absence of, you know, deep dives into, you know, what was actually going on in communities of color.
And in terms of, you mentioned you're alumnus of the Graduate Center. Were there any faculty there or any student movements that inspired you? Was that a continuation of some of the connections you'd made at the GC that built on your further activism? Or were you more of an activist after you graduated?
So my activism period as a student comes in my undergraduate years. And that, in fact, was at the college that I teach at right now. SUNY Old Westbury was a unique college within the SUNY system. And, you know, it's located on Long Island, but I lived on the Lower East Side. And when SUNY Old Westbury formed in the late 60s, it was an experimental college. It was a school that was geared toward providing greater access to higher education for segments of society that were, you know, labeled the historically bypassed. What that meant essentially were, you know, people of color, were working class people, veterans. It was the time of the Vietnam War, women. You know, in the late 60s and early 70s, the numbers of women in school, you know, in college were far lower than they are today. And so SUNY Old Westbury was a place that was formed to try to make up for, you know, the historical discrimination that had taken place. And so it recruited from the city. It recruited, its goal was to have, you know, diversity, 30% white, 30% black, 30% Puerto Rican at the time. Today we would say Latinx. And the college was a wonderful place. That's how I went there, because there were recruiters in the city. But within the first few years of its founding, there was a great deal of resistance in Long Island to all these folks from the city coming out to this wonderful 600-acre campus. And so the college students became embroiled in a battle to keep their access to the college, as the college began to shift and try to limit access to that population. So, you know, I was a student there and I was involved in the student struggles. And, you know, I became involved with this organization that I write about, that was itself involved in struggles against gentrification, against police brutality, for better education and healthcare, et cetera. So that's how I became involved. I didn't go to graduate school until after the organization had disintegrated, had dissipated, you know, which happened to many of the radical organizations. By the 1980s, by the early 1980s, many of these organizations that had fought in communities of color across the nation themselves began to dissipate. You know, there was such a conservative shift in the political economy of the United States, and it really became harder and harder to mobilize resistance against some of the, you know, pushbacks. So I didn't go to graduate school until, you know, after my political activism sort of, you know, died down along with the disintegration of those kinds of organizations.
And help our listeners understand a little bit about the sort of the historical background and some of the binary dichotomies or multiple dichotomies as we'd understand them of Puerto Rico, the independence versus a colonial domination, the movements towards independence, social activism, the occupation of the island, Vieques. How did that sort of shape your understanding and your writing of the book, sort of the colonial legacy, first with the Spanish and then with the American occupation?
So, I mean, that is some, you know, when I say we were community activists, we were also learning a great deal about U.S. imperialism at the time. Now, again, we're talking late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s. And in the 1950s, there had been a large migration of Puerto Ricans from Puerto Rico to New York, to mainly New York. They went to other cities as well in the Northeast, but large concentration in New York. This occurred through a collaboration between the colonial government in Puerto Rico. I'll come back to that in a moment. I just want to speak to the migration and how we became aware, we became involved in the colonial reality. This large migration occurs as the colonial government tried to lure manufacturing jobs to Puerto Rico. And as a result, in which they did through this program called Operation Bootstrap, and that resulted in the displacement of many people on the island, agricultural workers who were displaced, those who could not be incorporated in large enough numbers into manufacturing. And so they migrated to New York, lured by, you know, the possibility of better life like everyone. But at the same time, in those years, in the late 50s and 60s, there were groups that were coming to New York to talk to people about the colonial reality of Puerto Rico. And by that, I mean that, yeah, Puerto Rico, like Cuba, was a colony of Spain. It was colonized in the 1500s, and the United States acquired it from Spain as a result of the Spanish-American War. The United States acquired Cuba. Well, it didn't actually have direct colonial occupation of Cuba, but Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines were acquired as colonies. And the United States remains the colonial power in Puerto Rico, which means the island has a local government, but, you know, they are subject to the U.S. Constitution. They are subject to federal law and do not have voting rights for, you know, federal government. They have no senators. They have one resident commissioner in the House of Representatives who is not a voting member, but they cannot vote for president, et cetera. And we learned about this, you know, during the Vietnam War. This notion of U.S. imperialism was becoming more well understood by larger sectors of society. And in New York, you know, there were many demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And then, of course, you know, we learned about the Cuban Revolution, which was a source of inspiration for a lot of people. The idea of egalitarianism, you know, was obviously very popular. And so, you know, the situation in Puerto Rico remains, you know, an unresolved contradiction in a country that claims to, you know, embrace democracy and yet, you know, imposes rule in Puerto Rico.
Wow, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So that then brings us to the sort of the political economics of Puerto Rico and, you know, the corporations that went into Puerto Rico. And we'll talk a bit more about this towards the end, you know, of our conversation. Help our listeners understand the ridiculous advantages that were afforded to some of these corporations and how that has contributed to the impoverishment of Puerto Rico, of the island, and has led to this mass migration of its best and most brilliant human capital onto the mainland of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should just say that my book does not focus on Puerto Rico, on the political economy of Puerto Rico. I'm not an expert. I can say that one of the things the Puerto Rican government did, the local government, the colonial government, in cooperation with U.S. governmental agencies, was to provide wonderful tax benefits to corporations. The pharmaceutical industry was able to operate for years without paying taxes. Certainly, they did not have stringent environmental regulations. With regard to Vieques, Vieques was particularly tragic in that it is a small island off the coast of Puerto Rico, which belongs to Puerto Rico, occupied primarily by people who fish for a living. and the U.S. Navy occupied the land and waters of Vieques from 1947 through 2003. As a result, or in the course of this occupation, and of course the people of Vieques were never asked for permission for the occupation, but in the course of the occupation, many people were pushed back. A certain amount of land was cordoned off. Certainly much of the waters, the beautiful, pristine waters of Vieques, were used for target practice, for underwater amphibian exercises. And, you know, there was a prolonged battle led by the fishermen of Vieques to have the Navy leave, to oust the U.S. Navy from Vieques. Eventually, the Navy did go. And, you know, there's much debate about whether or how much of the Navy's exit was due to, you know, the mobilizations, the activism, and how much was just due to the fact that the U.S. had finished whatever it wanted to do there. I mean, I think the activism was extremely important. You know, I tell the story in the book. But, you know, today, Puerto Rico, the local government has been in debt that it cannot pay for a very long time, trying to provide just basic services. And the United States, as an example of the colonial status of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Congress formed a board, an external board, to oversee the restructuring of Puerto Rico's debt. And that restructuring involves austerity, the closing of schools, the firing of teachers, the firing of many public sector workers in general. And so, yeah, we have a situation right now of, you know, maybe 30 to 40% of poverty on the island. Large number of people, food insecure, as we now say, politely, to mean hunger, right? So, Puerto Rico finds itself in a very, very difficult situation. The local governments are often extremely corrupt. There was a huge movement on the island last year to oust the sitting governor, and they succeeded. That was Rosselló, was ousted. But the replacement governor is not much better. And right now, Puerto Rico is going through its own electoral process, as we are here in the United States. But, you know, it is hindered by this colonial status and desperate need for reforms in general, as we are.
Excellent. And I think that's a good place to segue and now think about, your correlation of all these dynamics in Puerto Rico and then how those are then translated for, you know, to El Comité and some of the Operation Moving and some of the making of a political movement in New York. You know, you relate some of the collaborations between Latinos and African Americans and some of the dynamics around gentrification and some of the unfair practices by landlords. Could you walk us through some of the dynamics around Operation Moving and some of the structures around El Comité?
Sure. And what I'd like to do is, you know, speak briefly to that and then, you know, try to make some connections to what we continue to experience today in New York City, because that's what I think is the importance. You know, I think we have historical amnesia sometimes in this country, and it's, you know, easy to kind of look at the super gentrification we have today in New York City and think this was just some sort of evolutionary process, some market phenomenon that occurred, and it's natural that it occurs and communities change, etc. But, you know, the history of El Comité, you know, tells us that no, you know, gentrification was a collaboration between the city and real estate developers and the finance industry in New York in the 1970s. And El Comité, you know, many of the people who formed this organization were the young people who came to from Puerto Rico in the 50s and 60s, more in the 60s. And, you know, some of them knew of, you know, the colonial situation. Many did not. But what they experienced when they came here was marginalization and, you know, pushed into very low wages, you know, working in kitchens, working as waiters, working in light industry, driving gypsy cabs, you know, cabs in parts of the city where yellow cabs didn't want to go, you know, living in overcrowded housing that was under maintained or just completely, you know, abandoned, living in terrible conditions that I describe in the book, you know, crowded conditions and often paying higher than average rents, which is, you know, a huge contradiction. And they find themselves side by side with African Americans. And, you know, the Operation Move-In that I talk about was just one example, albeit, you know, a huge example and a very successful one, but one example of squatters' movements in the city in the late 60s and 70s to try to push back on what the city was calling urban renewal, which activists, people in communities knew to be urban removal. In other words, what the city's proposals did in effect, what the city's actions to bring new development and renovation to neighborhoods in effect displaced or aimed to displace thousands upon thousands of families. And so, or, you know, even when the city promised to reserve some portion of new housing development for low-income or middle-income families, the fact is that the cost of those units was too high. And so, you know, there were many, many battles. El Comité emerged spontaneously just because they lived in the neighborhood. And, you know, there were bursts of anger. You know, there was an incident where, you know, a little boy died of carbon monoxide poisoning. And there were demonstrations in the street. And gradually that became more organized. You know, and they formed Operation Move-In. And they got support from tenant advocates and they occupied buildings and they refused to leave. The battle ensued for more than a couple of years. There were ups and downs. You know, I won't go into every, you know, detail, but let's just say that by and large, the activists were able to secure a number of buildings, to keep a number of buildings that the city eventually signed over to them as cooperatives. But in the longer term, gentrification proceeded as we know it today. And, you know, I would just use the example of my home in Williamsburg, that we are surrounded. My house is one of the last remaining houses. We are surrounded by these high-rise buildings where developers were able to get zoning variances and from the city. And, you know, the city poured vast resources into the neighborhood to improve parks, you know, to plant trees, to beautify the neighborhood for the enjoyment of people who have very substantial resources, and working people have been pushed out. And this is the tragedy of New York, I think, and many other cities that are undergoing, you know, the same processes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So would the occupation, things like, you know, movements like Operation Move-In, do you feel if organizations like El Comité were still strong and active as they had been in the past, that some of the gentrification and high rises that we see today would have been reduced or, you know, eliminated?
Well, I mean, that particular organization and many like it, you know, I have to say, you know, ran its course. I do think, you know, and you know, there are many reasons organizations form and dissipate. There is no doubt that collective mobilization, organization is absolutely necessary. And I think we see a lot of that, you know, today. I mean, we see a resurgence of activism. I mean, this is actually a very good time for this conversation because, first of all, it is the 50th anniversary of the founding of El Comité. And so there are conversations going on, like conversations like this going on. But it also, at this particular moment, we're having this conversation at the time of the pandemic, which has really crystallized many of those persistent conditions of racism and steep inequality that people were fighting back then. And at the same time that these conditions are crystallized, I think we're also experiencing a resurgence of activism. Of course, you know, the protests mobilized by Black Lives Matter and, you know, the climate justice movements, you know, the multiracial protests that we've seen across this country, they're very, very important. But on the community level, yes, I do think people need to talk to each other and mobilize and not think that there are individual solutions. You know, this individualism in this country has the idea of it, the idea that an individual can create a fulfilling and safe and prosperous life alone, you know, is an absurdity. I mean, we see this around the whole battle, the battles of the masks. You know, there is such, we can't wear a mask because, you know, it inhibits freedom. No, you know, a collective action can bring us prosperity as a society. I believe that's what I would say.
All right. Good point. And Could you speak, you know, I know you'd mentioned a little earlier about a historical amnesia. A lot of the move-in, Operation Move-In issues, the social justice issues are very much tied in with issues of immigration. Could you speak to that specifically within this chasm of, you know, the Latino community? Because we know Puerto Ricans can come in and out of the U.S., but there's a lot of other Latino communities that don't have that, you know, ability and, you know, just face a lot of immigration bottlenecks and issues. How was it back then in terms of organizing with other Latinos, say, from Mexico or the DR, the Dominican Republic? How did that tie into sort of the broader issues of Operation Move-In?
Yeah, so I would say that I don't think there was a significant Mexican population in the city or Central American. You know, the Salvadorans came in larger numbers in the 80s and 90s, especially during the Civil War. And Mexican population, I don't think was significant in terms of numbers. The Dominican population was. And so many Dominicans came in the mid-60s and came legally. The United States, you know, both. The United States had supported the dictator in the Dominican Republic, Trujillo.
Mm-hmm. Trujillo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when Trujillo was killed and unrest ensued in the DR, the United States did allow for, you know, some immigration from the Dominican Republic. And then even after, in the 80s, there were, even under Reagan, there were family reunification policies in place. So, yeah, there were Dominicans in the Upper West Side, and the Dominicans were very political. But they had their own organizations, MPD, MPD, the Popular Dominican Movement, I guess, would be the English. And they lived in large numbers in the Washington Heights. And so there was definitely support for the movement from the Dominican community for the movements, the squatters movement. There were a couple of Dominicans in El Comité. And so I would say the two, Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, were closely allied. Let's say that politically. You know, today, the question, the treatment of immigrants is, you know, another, in my view, U.S. tragedy, right? Policies at the border of family separation are just, you know, inhumane, to say the least, cruel. And the idea that people can come in legally or stand on the line is, I think, you know, just a myth. It's very, very hard to acquire a visa legally if you are in Central America or Mexico. And so, you know, we certainly need to deal with our immigration contradictions as soon as possible so we can stop the harm that we've been doing to families.
In the middle part of the book, you talk about that shift from community organizing to radical politics. How much of that was an offshoot to the anti-war demonstrations and, you know, the Black Power, Red Power, and, you know, Latino organizing of the 70s? And how much was that also part of the economic deterioration and the effects of the war and the deficits created from that?
Well, I can say that that transformation from a community organization to a more radical organization was a process, many factors, were involved in that transformation. But, you know, I think we can group all of those factors under the rubric of political education, political maturity, right? The exposure, certainly from the very beginning, community activists, you know, even in the housing movement, you can see signs about hanging from people's windows about things that were going on in Chile, right? Remember that in 1970, again, they had was elected. He was a socialist. He was elected in Chile. And in 1973, he was overthrown by a military coup. So, you know, the Vietnam War was certainly a factor. The Black Power movement, the Young Lords. And don't forget about the Young Lords.
Yes. Who were on the you mentioned them in the book. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons, one of the motivations for writing the book is to redress, to confront the assumption also, or the partial history, that the Young Lords were the activist organization of the Puerto Rican community. They were very important. They were influential, but they were short-lived, and there were only one of several organizations. And, you know, one of the reasons that groups like El Comité are not as well known as the Young Lords is because as they became more radical, as they became more left or more socialist, or as their critique became more of an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist critique, they were subject to red baiting. They were subject to marginalization, right? Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. So in their community struggles, they would often not identify themselves as, hello, I'm a member of a radical organization called El Comité MIMP, and I am a socialist, or, you know, whatever. I mean, they would not, they would just do the work of mobilizing, raising the issue, educating the community, fighting back against healthcare cuts, you know. And at the same time, they wrote, you know, they had a newspaper, and they would seek to educate people about the larger political economy, the forces that are not necessarily as obvious or as visible, right? You know, the forces of capitalism and, you know, greed and the accumulation of capital and the inequality, et cetera. So they sought to educate people, but about their larger critique and their vision, while at the same time fighting for reforms, you know, against hospital closings and you know, all the things I've mentioned before. And I think today we see a resurgence at the same time that the pandemic crystallizes, you know, these inequalities. We also see a resurgence of interest in socialism, in the idea of collective problem solving. Mm-hmm. Even if it's incremental, you know, problem solving that puts people's needs above, you know, greed and profit and all the rest.
All right. How was it organizing at that time? Was El Comité, you know, was it very egalitarian? Were there sometimes tensions around gender roles, and how were those addressed, the role of women in the movement?
Oh, my. Okay, so how was it organizing and egalitarian? Okay, so those are several questions. I want to say something about organizing. We didn't have social media, obviously, and, of course, one of the pros of that is that you can mobilize people, you know, without money. You don't need to print flyers. I mean, that's what we had to do. We had to print flyers and go door to door and collect quarters, you know, to put out a newspaper. So it was definitely more labor intensive than we have today. But social media does not replace the face-to-face work that it takes, right, to bring people together and you know, to develop strategies and tactics and a vision. You know, there, I don't think even today, there's anything that will replace that face-to-face organizing. We still have to do it. Egalitarianism. I mean, yeah, you know, all of the isms that we struggle to overcome exist within our families, right? Exist within our social circle, social circles, our culture. And so, yeah, we had to combat sexism. And that's not to say it was overcome, but we had a women's commission, you know, that tried to deal with the fact of chauvinism in our lives. You know, I have many stories, I have some stories in the book, but yeah, look, you know, not only the struggle against sexism, but the struggles against racial hierarchies, racism within our own communities, you know, was ongoing and is ongoing.
And you then talk about resisting cutbacks, imagining the revolution, and it would seem to me the 75 to 80 period, then you have sort of the Reagan devolution, Reagan sort of a very conservative neoliberal economics that went into the 90s with all these cutbacks to social programs, health and human services, and you know, public provision of public goods, right? Basically getting government out of providing for the poorest of the poor and those who were really struggling, and privatizing a lot. Do you see there, you know, I know you mentioned we want to move, get out of this historical amnesia, right? But are there certain similarities in terms of the cutbacks then and the reactions to the cutbacks then, the radicalization and organizing, and the cutbacks in the neoliberal age, globalization, and the current reactions to more empathy, to more of a public concern around public health, and more of a need to have the government there to provide for, you know, for the whole society, and particularly for those who are struggling and cannot provide for themselves?
So I think there's a bit of a contrast between the neoliberal turn and the impact it had on, you know, mobilizing, and the actually, you know, the politics of austerity today that I think is provoking a reaction among large numbers of people. So let me explain. I think, you know, if we could just look at the present for a moment, it's similar right now to the mid-70s in that we're confronting a crisis. And just here in New York, we're being talked to with the politics of austerity. In other words, even from, a Democratic governor, you know, who has been a very strong figure in terms of using the tools of government to combat the pandemic, we're now being told that we have to deal with cutbacks, right? And that's real. You know, they're real strains on the budget, right? But, again, that austerity is supposed to be borne by working people, right? We're threatened with cutbacks. We're threatened with job losses. We're threatened with cutbacks to school budgets, you know, healthcare crises, layoffs, et cetera, et cetera. And there are two paths we can take, you know. We can succumb to that politics of austerity and be fearful and say, oh my gosh, you know, we just have to bear this, and we bear it as individuals. Or, you know, we can come together and understand that we can, even with the budget constraints, reprioritize people's needs. In the mid-70s, this phenomenon was a national conservative fight back that was gaining momentum and power, a fight back of, I would say, capitalism, of the, you know, of capitalists against the more liberal era of the 30s through the 60s, right? And of course, you know, capitalism itself was going through, you know, its own transformation. U.S. companies were being challenged by companies from abroad, from Japan and Germany, et cetera. Point being that, you know, the way that manifests itself in New York was through this fiscal crisis in the mid-70s, which was really used as an opportunity for the politics of austerity and neoliberalism to, you know, blast social programs, to blame social programs for all of the challenges that we were experiencing economically. So, you know, and that really made it very difficult. People were concerned about losing jobs and concerned about fighting for the resources that their communities had gained previously. And so mobilizations, you know, became more difficult, let's say. You know, eventually, I mean, through repression, through discrediting movements, through discrediting liberalism, right? Social liberalism, a lot of these movements dissipated. Now, you know, will they reemerge? I think, you know, we're seeing some of that, and hopefully they will gain strength.
Fantastic. And you, towards the concluding parts of your book, you talk about these cadre dilemmas, and specifically that, you know, El Comité, you know, was not very enthusiastic about engaging in you know, in electoral politics. Could you speak, you know, a bit to that and sort of some of the decisions around that particular issue of not getting engaged in sort of electoral politics? And then how did these dilemmas, were they ever resolved? You know, within the sort of the politic of El Comité?
So, no, they were not resolved. I would say that the dilemmas outlived the organization. Post-organization, many of the former members became involved in electoral politics. Many, in fact, went to work as Latinos for Dinkins, helped to get David Dinkins elected as the first Black mayor of New York City. And, you know, the electoral politics dilemma was the idea that the two mainstream parties in the United States were both represented the interests of the capitalist system, even if one was more inclined to, you know, promote and advance, you know, slight reforms now and then, right? The Democratic Party, that both essentially, that it was, you know, they were two sides of the same coin. They were both imperialist parties. They were both, you know, parties that had supported U.S. imperialism, U.S. militarism overseas. And so they weren't far apart. And so, you know, the idea was to try to pursue an alternative, a more just, a more egalitarian alternative. That has changed. You know, as I said, you know, maybe that was short-sighted. Maybe it wasn't. Some of the more radical organizations of that period did participate in electoral politics. As I said, former members of this organization went on to push, let's say, progressive policies within the Democratic Party. And if we jump to today, I think there's a greater understanding in general by progressives of the need to use the systems available to us, as well as, you know, the more, you know, disruptive protest approach to social change. I think they probably complement one another. You know, you're not going to get much significant change unless the progressives you've elected are held accountable by people's movements and are pushed, in fact, by people's movements. So I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a wonderful example of a great electoral achievement. And, you know, my current work, I mean, you know, I would just say that, you know, my current work is to just try to contribute a thought piece now. I'm working on a manuscript on how two aspects of social change. One, that labor is still at the center of a system that can bring about, if mobilized, if workers are mobilized, and they are a very powerful sector, right? And a potentially powerful sector. You know, it's still in the Marxist tradition of really focusing on, you know, the potential that working people have to bring about fundamental change in a society. But also the second part of that is how to connect, you know, social movements to one another and how to interact with legislative processes to bring about incremental change and hopefully more fundamental change.
And how do you see that happening in a post-populist or in a populist and, you know, political framework? I mean, Trump with all the populism and now people seem disillusioned by that. And like, where do you see us going in terms of you're organizing the history of the way you've seen things in the past? You know, where do you see us in 20, 30, 50 years from now in terms of where's the country going? Is it going to take a dive towards maybe a more politics of austerity vein, a more even deeper entrenchment into capitalism, or is socialism or more of, you know, a more neo-Marxist construction of government and policy going to take, you know, a deeper route? People are going to start looking at, you know, some of the more radical left-leaning thinking, you know, they're going to take it a bit more seriously.
Well, I'm going to go with Rosa Luxemburg here and say, I don't know, but we have several paths. One certainly is barbarism, right? You know, and then there are, you know, several more promising and hopeful paths. I don't know. You know, all I know is that we have a crisis, you know, an existential crisis with our on our planet, right? And, you know, if we don't address that, you know, we just have to keep fighting for people to recognize the seriousness of the challenges that confront us and, you know, for, you know, incremental and even, you know, more fundamental change. You know, I don't know what the solutions are. I know that we have to find collective solutions, that these individual paths, this emphasis on consumerism, the disappearance of collective spaces, you know, this, it actually brings me back to gentrification in the sense that, you know, back in the 70s, at least we had physical spaces where people could go, even to enjoy music, right? You know, talk about multiculturalism. I mean, the opportunities for people to interact, you know, were tremendous in the 70s in New York. Today, we have increased segregation and fewer and fewer community spaces. And so we've got to find, you know, the commons, those areas that we can come together and act together, unless I fear that we go down that more onerous path.
So we're coming towards the end of our conversation, and we've had an incredible conversation with you. Thank you so much. I'll ask a traditional final question, you know, here on the New Books Network in collaboration with the Gotham Center. I teach young people. A lot of my students are very disillusioned with the status quo. They're disillusioned with the Democratic Party. A lot of them wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders to, you know, as an alternative to bring more change, or at least some form of radical change. And a lot of them just want to sit home. They're frustrated. They're angry. They say their vote doesn't count. From your history organizing with, you know, these students of color, Latino, African-American, you know, and even a lot of the white students, how do you re-engage them? Get them off their cell phones, get them off the iPads, re-engage them and make them feel that they need to understand the political process and all hope is not lost.
Yeah, I mean, much longer discussion, vital it is. I mean, I am constantly, my students are all, for the most part, are working class students. You know, they are riddled, they have a debt. You know, their families have multiple challenges. We talk about the conditions all the time. And I emphasize that non-action is allowing those conditions to persist, that if we don't hold elected leaders accountable, both at the voting booth and in the streets, that, you know, we cannot expect any relief, any improvement in our lives, that if we, and history is very, very important. If we look at any period of significant change, it is made by social movements, by political movements, often led by young people, working people in the streets, you know, from the workers' strikes, you know, the strikes for, you know, better conditions for safety, to, you know, the fights against apartheid in this country. None of the changes that we celebrate, none of the reforms that we celebrate were accomplished because somebody, you know, in some ivory tower decided to be nice and bring us these reforms. They were fought for. And being actionless only reinforces, you know, our weakness. But the other thing I would want to say is that they're right about the institutions of government, of the political process in this country, makes it very, very difficult to bring about change through the electoral process alone. You know, the two-party system, Bernie Sanders was, you know, pushed out of the process by, you know, people who were really concerned about the support he had. You know, the mainstream of the Democratic Party went all out to, you know, discredit him. But, you know, the two-party system is tough. You know, we don't have a system of proportional representation. That would be better. But we can still fight for those changes. We have to fight for things like proportional representation, for, you know, a greater political space for minor parties, for third-party candidates. And, you know, we need to fight all the systemic problems that we have in the street as well.
Yes, thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate you sharing with us, you know, this amazing work that you've done. Would you consider a sequel to this in 2020? It's been quite some time since you wrote last. Radical imagination, radical humanity. Would you consider doing a 2.0 version? In 2020?
Yeah, the manuscript I'm working on now, you know, speaks to a little bit more to where we are now. And okay. I hope that will be forthcoming. Who knows?
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Dr. Muzio. I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for being here on the New Books Network in collaboration with the Gotham Center. Listeners, we have been speaking to Dr. Rose Muzio about her excellent book on the radical imagination, radical humanity, Puerto Rican political activism in New York. And thank you so much for listening. And until next time, have a good evening.